Ultimate wholeness is achieved when the body is strong and well-developed, and the soul, vital and cultivated, leads all the faculties of the body in the service of the intellect, which is God's will in his world. So on the collective level of Israel, God ordained these two faculties, a faculty corresponding to the physical entity that aspires to material improvement of the nation, and a second facet devoted to the cultivation of spirituality. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 167, Rav Kook in the Holy Land. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was one of the most unlikely places on earth in which to find a Talmudic giant. Yet even more surprising was not where the rabbi was, but his reflection on what he found. During World War I, Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Kook, then the chief rabbi of Jaffa, found himself stranded in London. Though, of course, much of his time was spent immersed in Torah study, Rabbi Kook also sought inspiration at the National Gallery. There was one painter there in particular to whom the Torah scholar gravitated. The rabbi recalled his visit in a remarkable quote. He said, quote, "When I lived in London, I used to visit the National Gallery, and my favorite pictures were those of Rembrandt. I really think that Rembrandt was a tzaddik. Do you know that when I first saw Rembrandt's works, they reminded me of the rabbinic statement about the creation of light? We are told that when God created light, it was so strong and pellucid that one could see from one end of the world to the other, but God was afraid that the wicked might abuse it. What did he do? He reserved that light for the righteous in the world to come. But now and then there are great men who are blessed and privileged to see it. I think that Rembrandt was one of them, and the light in his pictures is the very light that God created on Genesis Day." What could Rav Kook have seen in Rembrandt's art? What was the light of which he spoke? As I argued in Mosaic, though Rabbi Kook's quote about Rembrandt is often cited, few note the context in which it occurred. Rabbi Kook's reflection was first told to a Jewish artist and sculptor by the name of Melnikov, in the course of a halakhic consultation. Melnikov was aware of biblical warnings regarding graven images and was wondering if there was a permissible way, according to Jewish law, to sculpt human beings. He wrote, quote, "One day I talked to the late Rabbi Kook about this prohibition. I asked him whether it is true that somewhere in our holy commentaries there is a passage which says that under certain conditions sculpture is allowed to be done by Jews. The rabbi knitted his brows. Let me see, he was saying to himself. A few moments later, he brought down huge gemaros from the shelves. He piled them up on the table. He opened one after another, moving his delicate fingers along the lines of the Holy Script as he read." End quote. Thus, Rabbi Kook is depicted studying the matter in gemaros, meaning volumes of the Talmud. And Melnikov adds, quote, "At last he stood up triumphantly. Here it is, he said. Now listen to what our sages say about your question. I don't remember the exact wording he quoted, but it was something like this. Our sages say," he read out, "that it is allowed to Jews to make images if they are done imperfectly and maimed." This made me laugh. "Why are you laughing?" he asked. "Because my work is far from being perfect." Now it was his turn to laugh. He was all kindness. End quote. It was then, at this point, according to Melnikov's recollection, that Rabbi Kook told Melnikov about experiencing Rembrandt in the National Gallery. Understanding what is special about Rembrandt then for Rabbi Kook must be understood through the context of this conversation. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs has suggested that Rabbi Kook's reference to the luminance of creation that he saw in Rembrandt's art referred to, quote, "the light Rembrandt saw in the faces of ordinary people without any attempt to beautify them. His work let us see the transcendental quality of the human, the only thing in the universe on which God set his image," end quote. To look not at imperfections, but rather at the light. This was Rembrandt. In an interesting way, the ability of seeing with a unique perspective was also something to be found in the life of Rabbi Kook, a man who arrived in the Holy Land at a hinge moment in Zionism, the year that Herzl passed away. And it was Rabbi Kook's impact on the future of religious Zionism in the land of Israel that would be profound. Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Kook studied and exhibited Talmudic brilliance at the premier yeshiva of Eastern Europe, Volozhin, in the end of the 19th century. After serving in the rabbinate in Eastern Europe, he became chief rabbi of Jaffa in 1904. Ultimately attaining that same position in Jerusalem, and then becoming the Ashkenazic chief rabbi of British Mandate Palestine, until he passed away in 1935. Rabbi Kook's enormous impact on religious Zionism would come not only from his Jewish legal responsa and leadership, but also from his theology, his religious reflections, which pondered from a religious perspective the fact that a return by the Jewish people to the land, a building by the Jewish people of the land, and a creation of a Jewish state was taking place, to a great extent, through Jews that did not have a profoundly traditional connection to Jewish faith. One small example of Rabbi Cook's reflecting on this fact religiously can be found in the eulogy that he delivered for Herzl, who shockingly passed away in 1904 at the age of 44. The eulogy for Herzl is enormously complex, and I'm only giving a few strands of it, citing a translation found on the Machon Shlomo Oman website. But to summarize it in simplified form, Rabbi Cook outlined the role played in Israelite history by two tribes, Joseph and Judah. Joseph, Rabbi Cook argued, was, from his moment at Pharaoh's court, the political actor par excellence. Judah, David's ancestor for Rabbi Cook, embodied the spiritual destiny of the people of Israel. The goal, he argued, is for what both embodied to be united for the good of the people, the material and the spiritual, the political helping to make manifest the theological. As he put it, quote, "The key to understanding this dichotomy lies in examining the individual human being. God created a man, a body and a soul, and corresponding to them, forces that strengthen and develop the body, as well as forces that strengthen and cultivate the soul. Ultimate wholeness is achieved when the body is strong and well developed, and the soul, vital and cultivated, leads all the faculties of the body in the service of the intellect, which is God's will in his world. So on the collective level of Israel, God ordained these two faculties, a faculty corresponding to the physical entity that aspires to material improvement of the nation, and a second facet devoted to the cultivation of spirituality." End quote. Rabbi Cook's point, in other words, was that Herzl served a significant, important, crucial, providentially designated role in the history of the Jewish people, that at a time when many Jews and religious communities were not poised to act in a profoundly political way, this gifted man, this Jew from Vienna, became a Jewish political actor par excellence for the good of the Jewish people. But, Rabbi Cook added, whereas many Zionists were seeking normalization of the Jewish people, ultimately, for him, for Rabbi Cook, the building of the Jewish state was meant to be a stepping stone for reflecting Israel's miraculous destiny. Or as Rabbi Cook put it, quote, "It behooves us to take to heart to try to unify the tree of Joseph and the tree of Judah," end quote. This is one small aspect of Rabbi Cook, a man who would show immense respect for the Jews that built the land, Jews of the Zionist movement, however secular they may have been, while still yearning for a moment when the spiritual destiny of the Jewish people would be made manifest through Zionism's achievements. One remarkable reflection of his respect for the Jews that worked the land of Israel can be discovered in a recently released recording on the internet of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, describing an experience that he had when he visited Israel in 1935. As part of the trip, Rabbi Soloveitchik visited a kibbutz whose members Rabbi Soloveitchik describes as very secular. Rabbi Soloveitchik assumed that none of the food at the kibbutz was kosher, and these Jews at the kibbutz explained to Rabbi Soloveitchik that there was a rabbi who had actually arranged for everything to be perfectly permissible as far as eating was concerned according to Jewish law. Knowing how secular these Jews were, Rabbi Soloveitchik asked them why they had a kosher kitchen. The Jews on the kibbutz in turn told Rabbi Soloveitchik that they had become kosher ever since they had once been visited by Rabbi Cook. Rabbi Soloveitchik then reported what these kibbutzniks told him about Rabbi Cook's visit. Rabbi Cook had come to this kibbutz for Shabbat, bringing his own wine and bread for the Shabbat meals. Friday evening, he ate his Shabbat meal as the Jews on the kibbutz ignored him. As Rabbi Soloveitchik put it, quote, "And they switched off the light. They didn't care about him. They simply ignored his presence as if he hadn't come to their place," end quote. The next morning, they didn't help Rabbi Cook with the prayer quorum. And as Rabbi Soloveitchik further put it, quote, "The same the whole day. They were cooking and sewing like a regular day. They didn't make much fuss about him," end quote. Then Rabbi Soloveitchik further reported after Shabbat, quote, "Then they had a gathering. So he joined the gathering and he began to dance with them, tell them stories about his past, about his father and mother, absolutely not indicating disapproval, even by one word, disapproval or censure with regard to their behavior during his sojourn," end quote. As Rabbi Cook said goodbye the next day, he said to them the following, "V'lehitraot, v'leachol biyachat suda achat. See you again, and may we eat together one meal." Said Rabbi Soloveitchik, quote, "That's what he said. The next day, all the dishes were thrown out, and the kitchen was converted into kosher." And Rabbi Soloveitchik added, "You asked me, what was the power he simply, so to say, exerted? What power of his personality? He was a religious personality. He was in love with Yahadut," end quote. Meaning Rabbi Cook was in love with Judaism, and he exuded love of Judaism in a way that impacted his fellow Jews. And Rabbi Cook was, of course, in love with the Jewish people finding wonder in the role these Jews were playing in the restoration of the Jewish people to the Holy Land. This remarkable man, Rabbi Cook, arrived in the Holy Land in 1904. He will appear again in our episodes, and as one can tell from this wondrous story reported by Rabbi Soloveitchik, he will, in this story that we are telling, have a vast impact in various ways on the future of Judaism in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.